Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
It's double goddamn motherfucking feature.
Hey, fuck something. Do it again.
Watch one film. Do it again.
My name is Eric, and I'm here with Brian Warner, Michael Kester. I don't know. Hey, can I tell you about something?
I need to know. Yeah.
What are we doing? Let's do this the right way. There's spoilers. You can skip over the films. Michael's going to tell you what the films are.
The films today are The Earrings of Madame Day and The Paths of Glory.
And we're going to spoil those films. So if you don't know how they start or end or what happens in between those parts, go ahead and use the chapter, skip over them. I know I've been talking to you about this basically every time you will lend me your ear, but there's a lot of remasters to do.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of them.
I bet.
You know, 53 of them.
Sure.
And even if they only took, say, 10 minutes each to do, it would still take 100 years to finish them if you do that math.
Math, yeah.
So I'm just going to be working on them a while. But it's weird going back. It was about this time in the first year run of our show. I was getting all excited. My DVD was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
The Birthday Massacre DVD.
Mm-hmm.
And so because once you have to work on something, it becomes a job. I was looking to do something that wasn't the remasters. So I decided I'm going to bust out that Birthday Massacre thing again. You know, it was created in the early days of YouTube. I bet we could maybe polish it up a little bit. I actually kind of learned to edit from that whole project.
Mm-hmm.
That was for people who haven't heard year one, and I realize that's most people because it's still not done yet, but soon, bear with me. I snuck a camera into a show in a giant goth boot, and I used it to tape a concert that I then cut together and gave to the band being the Birthday Massacre. Some friends of mine from Canada, people I knew because I found their band on mp3.com, and developed kind of an odd working relationship, sort of weird thing. Just cool guys. And so I made this video, and they didn't have anything on YouTube. So it was a big deal just to get video content onto the internet and have people able to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was satisfactory at the time. But now I consider this, you know, this Birthday Massacre video to be one of the things I've worked on.
Right.
I mean, as far as feature length, it's the only thing I've directed that's feature length. And directing is used kind of dubiously there. But you watch it now, and it's just, man, fuck, it's terrible. So I decided to go back and try and fix all that awful now that I know how to edit. And returning full circle to the thing I kind of cut my editing teeth on. So anyways, that's done.
Good.
So if you want that, you can get it for free. It's at tbmchicago.com. I did a surround mix. It's remastered in high definition. Did some color correction. The audio isn't fucking terrible. I'm just excited about it. So go over there, stop listening to this show, and watch a band you've never heard of on a thing. Anyways.
Ah, the French.
The Earrings of Madame Day was a movie that Enrique had recommended to us.
Oh, didn't he produce last week's show?
Different Enrique, actually. Completely different.
Wow, okay.
Two Enriques that listen to our show of the five total people who listen. Two are named Enrique.
Dos Enriques.
I need you to explain something to me.
Me? You're talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay.
How the fuck does Paris wife swap work? What's the deal here?
What do you mean?
What is this? Polygamous? Are we just not acknowledging something's going on? Is it a secret?
It's, so Paris being the city of love, France being the city, the nation of romance, you just kind of fuck around on each other. It's olden days. You just fuck around.
That's just how it goes.
So the basic idea of this film is that the couple being portrayed, the, I would say eponymous couple, however you never get the name, but the madam and her husband, they're not in what would be considered the healthiest, most functional relationship. And so he's cheating on her and she's more or less cheating on him, I suppose, out of revenge, out of, there's various and sundry reasons that she may be cheating back. But for me, I find this film interesting because of the fact that it's, the first half is so interesting in trying to figure out what's going on.
Oh yeah, for sure. You start with the enigma.
Right. And by the time the earrings return back to the madam of the title.
The titular madam.
That's when I remember the title, the intro card, where they say she probably would never have led a very interesting life, or, you know, nothing of major import would have ever happened to her aside from this, these earrings. And by the time they return to her, you'd think, well, okay, that was quite a ride, but Pee-wee did find his bike in the end.
Right.
Instead, by the time she gets the earrings back, the can of worms has been fully opened. I mean, the method by which the earrings are returned is so emblematic of troubled human relationships.
Yeah.
That the earrings themselves no longer are a factor in the film.
I'm amazed how much that becomes compounded over time, especially with that title card. You assume we're setting up a sort of Three Stooges routine here. Oh, we're talking about how these two people don't communicate. So one's going to pawn the earrings and then the other's going to buy them back for her and hilarity is going to ensue. And we do that little routine the once, and then these earrings come back in another way and then another way. And the narrative doesn't always reset. We're not always going, ah, act two, the earrings have returned and now we're doing this and now act three. Sure. The earrings weave in and out in a way that I don't think ever becomes expected. They're always trouble in a new manner. They're always representative of a new issue that has come up or perhaps caused it. And they weave in and out of that without it becoming a pattern for, especially a pattern for comedy. You know, it could very easily be that she gets these earrings and for whatever reason has to sell them. And then for whatever reason, he buys them back and they just keep doing this. Or even even that that's ever how they come back to her. But they come back to her in different ways. And sometimes those start the next cycle of conflict. And sometimes they show up in the middle of a conflict when things couldn't possibly get any worse. And now we have the fucking earrings to deal with on top of this. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're punishment. Sometimes they're thrown in a character's face. I think about the scene where he has them. She's laying in the bed. He comes back to her and says, oh, and look, the earrings. And she gets all excited. She's happy to see them again. She's thinking about her wife swapping love. And he basically uses them to exert his dominance and control over her and goes, these aren't yours anymore. Mm-hmm. These are mine now. I'll tell you what to do with them. I mean, that scene isn't there so that a new chapter can begin or we can, you know, have something else to, it's not a writing device. This isn't a gimmick.
It feels like it should be closure at that moment. It feels like
right.
The whole thing should, the circle should close at that point.
I don't think it's opening or closing.
No, exactly.
I think it's just getting, a situation's getting worse. It's a gut punch.
Well, it's funny because it feels like the circle should be closing, but instead you realize that it's spiraling and it's not a circle.
Mm-hmm.
That by coming back around to where it began, so much has been put in motion and so much has been skewed from where it initially was that it's never going to return to where it was at the beginning of the story. It can't. It just simply cannot. For me, that scene is really funny too, because the look on her husband's face when the earrings come out of her glove, I just imagine what he's thinking because, you know, those are your earrings? Those are definitely yours. Those are the ones you had.
Sure.
I mean, he's thinking all, you know, what could have possibly brought these earrings back?
Well, because this scene is twofold. If you just watch the scene, you might assume this is the reveal that he knows it's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
But this is actually one more complex than that. He already knew it was a lie, and now he's not even quite sure how they got back to her.
Right.
He's a couple steps ahead here.
Yeah.
And this movie plays a lot with what I always think about as theatrical irony. I don't know if there's actually a a name for that. But the irony of that's used in more the sense of theater,
mm-hmm.
of a character will, an audience will know something a character doesn't.
Dramatic irony.
Is that dramatic irony? Is
Theatrical or dramatic irony, yeah.
It's kind of how that's used a little bit here. Really, there's an audience surrogate if we're going to look at it that way. But we know that a character knows something.
Mm-hmm.
And we're following this other character who we could call our protagonist, certainly the titular character. And she doesn't know the thing we know, which is that another character knows.
Right.
So it's sort of one level, one layer removed from that. But it allows us to have these very complicated emotions regarding something. Not only the feeling of, you know, of seeing the lies or the betrayal, but also things start to take on double meanings.
Mm-hmm.
He'll basically be catching her in a lie and asking about her feelings regarding the earrings or whatever. And we'll sort of see his coy. At first, it's almost funny to him. It's almost an amusing thing that's happened that she sold these earrings. And then he'll ask her about it. We know that he knows. And then we'll see her respond not knowing. And the thing she says, I don't know if you despise her for them. I don't know if we're meant to look at this character and go, who are you sympathetic towards in that moment? You're catching her in a lie, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly not lost on the film that she is not necessarily any better than her husband
mm-hmm.
on the initial playing field. It's just that he's worse first. You know what I mean? He gets bad first. And so we're constantly sympathetic toward her because she is also victimized.
Well, she's also selling a gift behind her husband's back.
Right.
I mean, I feel like she commits the first lie.
Hold on. What the fuck are you talking about? That's hers. Shut the fuck up. That's a stupid thing.
Okay, fine. No, it's okay to sell a gift.
If anybody sells anything.
All right. No, you're right. It's her property. It's just that it was gifted her. Look, yeah, it's considered
it's
considered not it's very rude. Tactful.
She's rude it's, at the right? beginning.
Okay.
She's not despicable. Okay. She's fucking rude. All that's right. All that is.
Well, listen.
That's like burping and not saying, excuse me, fuck that bitch. She's evil first.
We're playing Paris Wife Swap here. I don't know the rules. You have to explain this to me. I can't simply ignore this dynamic. I don't know if it has an impact on their life. I don't know.
To me,
everything I've learned about Paris Wife Swap, I've learned from Anna Karenina. So that's all.
Uh-huh.
That's all I know about that situation.
For me, the beginning of the film is a desperate woman trying to make ends meet. Okay, that's how I see it, and it's her possession. So fucking whatever.
A desperate and rude woman.
Rude, desperate woman making ends meet.
I've just decided to play devil's advocate to this, I guess.
And then her husband, who's already cheating on her, then takes something he once gave to his wife, and he's like, "Fuck that bitch! I'm gonna give it to this hotter piece." And then she goes and gets into trouble. Earrings come back. And right around the time the wife starts getting into about the same boat as her husband, where she is now also being unfaithful, the husband goes, fuck you. These are mine now. I'm a man. You're a woman. Sit the fuck down. And
sure.
Then you again go, okay, that guy's the bad guy.
Right.
She's just the rude woman.
Right. I want to stay at the gambling table. I want to stay at the roulette table.
Sure. Sure, but that's what Casino Royale's about.
I want to know more about her. What's going on with her?
Well, that's because in your mind you go, well, she lost the earrings, so next must be the blouse. That's what you're thinking.
That is what I'm thinking. No, I mean, I don't know. She gets this present. She goes back. She immediately spends it to gamble. She goes, oh, I lost all that money. Oh, I have to stop playing now. That's a bummer. I'm going to sell these earrings. Which I think is also rude, right?
The earrings of Madame de Rude. I think the earrings are emblematic throughout the film. The earrings are emblematic of, I don't want to say evil or anything that carries that much weight, but they're definitely emblematic of
the complexities of human emotion.
Misbehaving. I think that anytime somebody's in possession of the earrings, they do something. They misbehave. They do something they probably shouldn't do.
Right.
And it's interesting because it starts by selling them and being a rude little bitch, buying them back and being, I can't think of the word, a disloyal little bitch. And then you give them to this woman who barters them off for gambling chips. And then they come back around and the man who knows he shouldn't be cheating gives them to this woman who then lies to her husband and goes, oh, they were in this glove. Every time somebody possesses the earrings, they do something immoral.
I don't, it's not a bad lie with that glove. I mean, it sucks that he already knows, but
sure,
it man, would she have gotten away with
sure.
that?
Yeah.
I almost believe her, even though I know. Yep. I know, and I see a character that knows, and I still go, oh, they were in that glove that whole time.
If you really wanted to, you would have been like, must have been the wrong set of earrings.
Right, right. Well, because she has this incredible coincidence on her side. He doesn't expect her to have them back. They're halfway across the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason she would have them. And so when they come out of her glove, he almost goes, what the fuck? Did I dream this whole thing? What's happening right now?
I mean, I imagine that the first thing that goes through his mind is that fucking jeweler, that fucking guy sold me two pairs of earrings for an astronomical price.
Sure.
What a rude man.
Well, it's just hard to think that someone had gifted them to her the same way. The very ones that he saw travel away, not even just with his own eyes, but by his own hand. He sent those cursed earrings away and now they've returned. And I actually don't think he really looks like he's confused about it at all. But I, as an audience member,
sure.
I, as a human being, go, I just trust people who I see are fucking lying to me right on the screen. That's the point of the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, wait, guys, maybe this is a misunderstanding. Maybe they were in the glove. I saw her put them in the fucking glove.
And you still it's a pretty good alibi.
This is a story about how Eric 13 is the most gullible human being. I think that's what this is about. I also like what the earrings represent in the, I guess, the constantly shifting change in what they mean to people. Because this is a pair of earrings that she starts out with getting rid of because, you know, the irony here is she's getting rid of them because she doesn't even fucking like them. You know, and I mean, they bring that up a little bit later. This is a physical object, nothing magical about this object. It's just a physical object. It's made, manufactured, crafted in a certain way, and then sold. And the object does not change. It does not become another object over time. She gets rid of it because she doesn't have any affection for it. And it comes back to her. And those very earrings that she got rid of because she didn't like them are now the most precious objects in the world when they remind her of her other lover.
Mm-hmm.
So now she needs these. She craves them because it reminds her of him. The earrings are still the same. Earrings haven't changed. There's nothing, again, no magic here, right? They're just fucking earrings like they were before. But it's amazing. It reminds me of the James Randi serial killer thing. He brought some kind of, I don't know, a shirt or something. I don't remember exactly how this goes, but he brought a shirt or something into a classroom, an article of clothing. And he asked, you know, if people would touch it or pass it around or whatever. And then he said, what if I told you that this was actually owned and worn by a serial killer? How many people would still want to touch it? And suddenly everybody got very apprehensive about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same fucking shirt. It's not as if you're going to touch it and become a serial killer, but there is this sort of magic about it in the way we consider items in our mind. And so now these aren't, I mean, they're never just earrings. They're always a token, especially earrings that are gifted in that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like I just got back from tour in the Midwest and we went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you walk through that, it's fucking six stories of guitars and rings,
stuff you get
and
at Guitar
necklaces
Center.
Right, and just shit. You know, it's like a fucking piece of paper. It's like a coffee stained napkin. And it's like, probably belonged to Jimi Hendrix or was at a bar near him once.
Right.
And people are like taking pictures with them, like selfies next to it, you know?
Right. 10 cent guitar pick.
Sure.
Used by Slash. $200,000 guitar pick.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Goofy, ugly fucking costume worn by Peter Criss from Kiss. Amazingly avant-garde costume.
Oh, I need a selfie with that costume.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I really like something about that. Even though it's magic and I hate it, I also like something about the sentimentality that we can put into an item because of something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think about myself as a person who treats items sentimentally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things are just sticks of furniture. They're fucking pieces of plastic. and you can toss them out and get new ones. I don't get sentimental about things, but you do have items that remind you of a certain time or a certain person or a certain place.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they have inherent worth, which is sentimentality. What I'm just telling you is I'm a liar. I do apparently get sentimental about items. I go, oh, but those are the special earrings. They're the ones that fell out of the glove when I was caught in my elaborate lie. That's what they would remind me of at that moment.
Kubrick, Douglas, World War One. Kubrick, Douglas, World War One. Kubrick, Douglas, so World War One.
You want to talk about the path of glory?
Glory. Yeah.
Okay. That's your favorite film, Eyes Wide Shut.
I just bought that, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah.
No, you didn't.
I totally did. No, you didn't. I totally did.
Michael, what is happening?
It's a Christmas movie.
It fell out of a glove.
Yeah, it was in a glove.
Why did you buy Eyes Wide Shut? You couldn't stand Eyes Wide Shut.
Every year, I when the holidays come around.
You listen to an episode from year one, and then you do the opposite of whatever you said you would forever do in that episode.
Every year, I get on this kick during the holidays where I'm going to say fuck you to It's a Wonderful Life and fucking all these Christmas movies that you have to watch come the holiday season.
Right. And you watch Die Hard instead.
Die Hard and Gremlins. But I just watched Die Hard. And so I was thinking, well, what other alternative Christmas? And there's easy ones, you know, there's Rare Exports.
Yeah.
And Sint and stuff like that. Where
Bad
it's just,
Santa is my go-to for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something
that is like someone in a Santa suit with a middle finger on the cover. That's basically what those movies are.
I checked online for, I think my search was something along the lines of fucked up movies that take place on Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Eyes Wide Shut came up. It had been since we had seen it for the show that I had watched it. And my brain just started flashing Kidman, Cruise, Kubrick, and then just tits. It was just tits in between those
with
three
the piano
names.
Score with the two note piano score,
right?
Yeah.
And so I went fuck it. You know, I got 3 hours.
Not to constantly
DVDs cost 8 cents or whatever. I don't know.
Not to constantly bring up the fucking remasters, but I was just listening to myself go. But Michael, Kidman, Cruise, Kubrick, and then there's tits and they're just flashing. And what about that weird piano score? And you're like, that doesn't, what are you some kind of simpleton? You just buy movies because they have words and a title and say Kubrick and have boobs in them. And you just didn't understand me. And now here we are, year seven,
double
feature.
People change, things change.
You want to talk about Christmas? Can we talk about the Christmas fucking miracle that is a hour 20 minute Kubrick film?
Right. Can you?
I was wrong
that?
This whole time. There is a God. There clearly is a God, and he is Kirk Douglas.
Well,
so
if,
this came
if
out
so,
right
that
after.
That explains how he's 1,000 years old right now.
I love seeing movies that came out in ye olden time, where they didn't even have sound in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And no, this movie isn't that old. Kubrick does have a way, though. I remember when we saw The Killing. The Killing was a movie that came out before this.
Sure. The horse
and
movie.
I went, Kubrick did The Killing? That movie's from like 1912.
Yeah,
how did that?
Right.
How is this possible? I don't even recognize one fucking person in this.
What I think is so crazy about it is you look at the breadth of Kubrick's filmography,
mm-hmm.
and you look at the years of each of those films. And for me, I mean, basically from... I want to say probably about Paths of Glory to Eyes Wide Shut. I go, that movie is the definitive Kubrick movie. So that must be the year he was in his prime.
Sure.
You know what
sure.
I mean? From Paths of Glory to The Shining to 2001 to Clockwork Orange. Every time I think about that, I'm like, oh, no. He must have been in his prime in 70. No, I mean, or probably closer to 81 was when he was 29. Sure. He was 29 when he was making... The Shining in 84 or whatever. I don't think those are the right years, but whatever. And then and then you find out that Eyes Wide Shut comes out literally the year he died.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, so he was just, I mean, he probably came out of his mother's vagina with a film reel going, this is my first work. It will be,
right.
It will look like it was made by someone in their prime.
A lot of people don't know this, but half of Fear and Desire was actually pre-production was in the womb. So.
Yeah, well, the other thing that's really interesting is that the baby at the end of 2001 is actually an old Kubrick cameo from before he was born.
Well, if you remember Eyes Wide Shut, that was part of the big controversy is that people didn't know if if he really felt like he finished it.
Sure.
Or he died really before it was complete, or we could say before it came out. We don't know. That's the mystery. We don't know if he died before it was completed or not, but before it came out.
Nobody knows when or how he died, or if he even died at all.
No, we do have that information. We just don't.
I'd like to see a trial that definitely dictates whether or not he died at all and by whose hand and fault it was placed.
Well, I have some good news and some bad news. The mm-hmm. good news is I do have a trial for you.
Okay.
The bad news is rather than getting useful information about the death of Stanley Kubrick, we're instead just going to execute three totally innocent people. Okay. So I hope that's okay. I know the details are a little bit different than what you wanted, but I figured it's still a trial. So that's good, right?
That seems a little rude, but I think I can deal with it.
Actually, it's really less of a trial and more just of a public disgrace. Mm-hmm. But we do get to murder three innocent people
that's
at the end.
Can't go wrong with senseless murder of innocent people.
Oh my God.
So do you know if this movie is based at all on truth?
Yeah, but I mean, who knows what the fuck that means?
So it is.
I mean, Eyes Wide Shut was actually based on a dream that Tom Cruise was having as he was filming Eyes Wide Shut. So okay. Who knows what the fuck?
Right.
That's not true. What was that? Hotel Drugs Overdose? Is that what that was?
Sure.
Hooker?
Yeah.
Something. Hotel Drug. That sounds like a Manson lyric is what it sounds like.
Yeah,
actually.
It totally does.
Ex-Beauty Queen. That's what it is. Ex-Beauty Queen and Hotel Drugs Overdose.
Right.
Which I think is a lyric from Cupid Carries a Gun or maybe Deep Six or I don't know, one of those later Manson tracks.
I think it's the Mephistopheles of Los Angeles is what that's from.
Oh, Jesus. This is going to take over the whole end of the of year seven. It's just going to be all how is this Manson album exist? No, actually, I have something that'll get you carried away on a different tangent. How does this compare to the last 15 war movies we did this year?
So I guess war travesty, war commentary, I guess is probably a less biased way of putting it, is this year's bunch of kids kill somebody and have to figure out what to do.
Right.
Yeah. If you're going to go to war, you're going to have a bad time.
No, I think this is based partially on truth. It was also a movie about French people doing the wrong thing. That's a double feature about that. This makes the Earrings of Madame Day seem rather tame. I should say, to be proper, I will not confirm whether or not there were executions in the Earrings of Madame Day. The answer may surprise you. Look, what was I saying? Kubrick, war movies. This thing happened in France where people were declared cowards and then executed basically under, much like we talked about in Catch-22, a bunch of bureaucracy that doesn't make any fucking sense. Mm-hmm. And the absurdity was highlighted in, I think it was a play.
Mad
maybe
Magazine?
A book,
oh, okay.
In Mad Magazine, whatever they had in France at the time. And the play and the book were they were the Kubrick of the time. They were the sacred, Kubrick came to this trying to live up to it, probably in the same way as the sequel to 2001, going, oh, the iconic Kubrick, how could I have so much pressure? Kubrick's looking at this and being like, Les Paths de War. Your French is better than mine. I don't know what they, what they called this thing.
Les Paths de War.
Yeah, see, it sounds good when you say it. The original French tale of militant absurdity and saying, okay, I got to do this thing justice. And I don't even know why the Paths of Glory cares about its first half. Because when it gets to its second half, it is just owning you all over the place.
I know.
It's so fucking heavy. The first half is interesting because I don't know how farcical the movie is. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's trying to have a big laugh about these insane things people say during war, which is a point I think maybe the movie also is toying with. Is people just don't know the satire is indistinguishable from the sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it likes playing in that tone. But then you get to the second half and there's no joking. We are not having any fun here.
Right.
We are slaughtering people and then we are murdering people for not slaughtering people. And then there's a swell party.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because the depiction of war over the years, for me, always seems like one of the strangest pieces of humanity. I shouldn't even say the depiction of war, but I almost said execution of war. The methods of war when you go further back seems so strange. So now, since we're constantly at war somewhere, war basically looks like small groups of dudes rolling into places and clearing out. It looks like Call of Duty.
Oh, you're so wrong. War today looks like we hit a button and a country loses the internet for 3.5 hours. That's right. What war looks like.
Well,
no, you're talking about war as of a couple months ago, right, when it was still terrible.
Right.
But now it's just funny because people can't get on Facebook.
Right.
War is totally fine now.
But then you go back a few years and you get, man, this is weird to talk about because normally I'm having this conversation regarding Roger Corman's adaptation to video. But instead you go back to about the 70s and you get Vietnam, where the Vietnamese figured out how to do war better and we were still putting movies out in cinema and making no money.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when that's when guerrilla warfare really happened. But then you go back further to World War I, right? And that's when the sides actually had battle fronts. And you go, this is when you're in bad guy territory. Over here, you're in good guy territory.
Red team, blue
team.
Right
here's where we're going to play soccer on Christmas.
Yeah, right.
There's that. And then you go back even further to the Civil War. And that's when you get letters going, you, me, basketball court, next Sunday. And then groups of people show up and you wait. And then two people walk out and go, so what, you want to start this? What, noon? Noon 30?
Yeah, right.
You need a burrito? Right. Like, what's going on? Do you guys got craft services over there? No, yes.
Sure.
Are you letting me
make
know?
Make sure everybody has the same number of bullets and are pointing their guns at each other and firing at the same time.
And then they go, war.
Yeah.
You go even further back and then you get like,
you both take 10 paces turning shit.
Well, you get a letter from a country going, sir, I declare war with you. Do you accept war?
Right.
So anyway, we're at World War I, which is still a level of bureaucracy that's semi-transparent.
Mm-hmm.
That's what these war commentary movies are about. It's not that something that satirizes war the way Catch-22 or Paths of Glory do. It's not like that fucking ironic comedy of how war is run. That it's not like that doesn't go on anymore. That still goes on, but now it's all hush-hush because everybody made fun of it. You know, kind of like Community Season 4. It's like, nobody talks about that. But in World War I, it's still all papers and you sign it and you meet with your higher ups and they go, so I noticed that you planned this whole thing and got half of your troops killed. Would you like a promotion? Is that what this is about?
Right.
Are you, your sales numbers are up as well. So if you're looking to be head of the sales team, we do have an opening because your ploy ended up getting your superior fired. And all it took was half of your clients being slaughtered on a hill. And do you accept this position?
Yeah, I think now we look at that and we know that it's supposed to be viewed as absurd.
Sure.
But the problem that I was referencing earlier that I think this movie's addressing, and certainly if it's not trying to address it, I'm thinking about it anyways. So who fucking knows? We can't ask Kubrick now because ex-beauty queen and hotel drugs overdose. That's not why we can't. I don't know why I did that. But you think of the moment of the trial. And so the trial fails. There's spoilers in this podcast. The trial fails. And the trial is itself kind of a farce. I mean, it's less of a farce and more just that it's not even a fucking trial. It's just, it's a meeting. That's what it is. It's a war meeting.
Right.
A bunch of people have shown up to have a fucking meeting. And, Kirk gets out there and he outlines, hey, you bunch of idiots, don't you see what's going on here? And then he just explains what happened and he loses. And the interesting thing I think about him losing is that, you know, thinking how could he have won this? He goes out and he basically says, this is why this is absurd. And then just gives a factual recounting of what happened. So there's a divide here. And that's what I'm getting at. It's not that the way that this was portrayed is unfair in the movie. It just gives a factual account of what happened. And the people who carried out those actions don't realize how absurd they are. And the people who didn't look at it and go, wow, that was fucking absurd. So the thing is kind of a satire of itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's that level of commentary or parody that is indistinguishable from what it is satirizing.
Right.
when we did the documentary, Flock of Dodos.
Yeah.
That was something that you had picked up, is people who, it was a movie that was commenting on the creationism, really the intelligent design movement. And you thought that the intelligent design proponents, even though the movie seemed critical of them, would watch it and not think that the movie would, they would have watched it and gone, yeah, that's pretty much what it's like.
Right.
And I kind of feel that way about the war here. He shows up at the trial and he explains what happened. And he says, you know, the fucking sentence, I mean, this guy won 2 medals for bravery and now he's on trial for cowardice. And they look at the record and they go, oh yeah, you did get the right guy. Yeah. The one with the bravery medals. Uh-huh. And like I was saying, he's on trial for cowardice because he's a coward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things keep coming up in the trial of, so you, you ran forward and then what happened? Well, everyone around me died. And so what did you do? Well, they were all dead. So I turned around. So you retreated because you're a coward.
Right.
You can't, yeah. You just go, how are we not, what is the barrier here?
Yeah,
how
do it's we? Funny. It's funny because, yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. People would go, yeah, you people.
Don't you see what you're doing?
It's a witch hunt at this point. You're guilty when you take the stand, and the question, there's no way to answer that question and not sound like you're retreating.
Yeah, right.
The only thing I can, you run forward and die, you lay down and you're a coward, or you run back and you're a double coward.
Yeah.
That's one way of looking at it.
Well, so the mindset of the people who are conducting this trial, by extension, the mindset of the military, of these wartime bureaucrats is so, I mean, they think about it differently than people who don't have this mindset. And so they can't communicate. I think his failure in the trial is that he is so overwhelmed by the absurdity of the scenario to make strategic arguments. He didn't tailor his arguments for his audience, right? Because his audience is the type of people that would make these buffoon, they're the people who put men on trial for cowardice,
mm-hmm.
for doing their job. So to use what he would have, he thought he could go out there and just use logic, which in his mind is to say, you are putting these men on trial for cowardice. Look, this one won 2 bravery medals, as if they don't know those facts. And so instead of tailoring his arguments for his audience, he just kind of gets mad at them because they're insane.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you can hardly blame him. I don't want to sound like what he should have done is this, because this is one of the problems we have with reforming the military, with war, with religion, as I mentioned earlier, but really with people who are in such stern camps on different sides of political or, you know, military arguments, simply explaining to them that, say, gay people should have equal rights because, you know, they're humans. You and I look at that and go, yeah, wouldn't it be absurd? Once you say it like that, it's kind of hard to disagree. But then people who don't think that would look at it and be like, well, they shouldn't have equal rights just because they're humans. You know, there's a huge disconnect there. And bridging that is so hard because the other side just looks so fucking insane.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe I like the beginning of The Pass of Glory for that reason. I like that I can't tell if the movie is poking fun because it's just portraying what's happening,
sure,
you know, to these people. The other thing I did want to mention in Pass of Glory, though, is the last fucking scene. Which, honestly, I could have just done the whole show on that. They are in this little, I don't know, bar, saloon, whatever. They're taking a break from, I was going to do that thing where I'm like, they're taking a break from mindlessly slaughtering the enemy. And I would say that at a trial and they would be like, well, of course you should be mindless when slaughtering the enemy. They'd have no fucking idea that I'm, they have this poor woman up on stage and I feel like I'm repulsed by how utterly barbaric their reception of this woman is.
Mm-hmm.
She's on stage basically crying and they're committing some kind of mass orgy mind rape on her.
Sure.
Barking at her like animals. And this is my first and only time seeing The Paths of Glory. I say only because I just watched it. I didn't mean to make that sound like, and I'll never fucking watch this again.
Never watch it again.
Take that Paths of Glory. No, I'm going to buy it on DVD
in
6 years, clearly. Yeah,
right. Six. Year one plus six is seven.
DVD was really the thing you should have made fun of in that. No, I just mean that, you know, we just watched it. This last scene, my take on this is that, you know, everybody's being very barbaric. The audience, or maybe just me, is being extremely repulsed by it, feeling like I can't even watch these people, these men, you know, tear this poor woman down. And then she starts singing. And even though they don't know the words, which in my head is amusing, and maybe I'm completely misreading this whole scene, let me explain how it goes in my head, and we'll see if there's a disconnect. She starts singing. They don't know the words, so they mumble along, which is very endearing. And then everybody sobs because they accidentally had an emotional connection to a person that they were considering a piece of meat, a piece of enemy, an acquisition from the enemy, right?
Right.
I mean, is that about how you took this?
Yeah. No, yeah.
It seems, I mean, the setup for it, it is such a beautiful scene. They literally call her an acquisition from the enemy. They say, we will now wheel out it. It's almost a nice little vignette. They wheel her out like a trophy. They say, here's a trophy. A bunch of dudes grab their junk and start beating it. She starts singing. Everybody starts crying because, oh no.
The enemy is people too. That's the
enemy is people too.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Soylent Germans are people. Right. Well,
and the best part of this whole vignette is that it's not a vignette, that we actually have to get back to work. That we have this beautiful moment where we go, oh wait, World War One will be the last world war because a group of men here in this moment finally realize that the enemy is people too.
Yeah.
And then we get back to Kirk Douglas outside and he goes, you can give the men a couple minutes and, you know, tell them to get back to it.
Sure.
And credits. You just go, oh, fuck.
I always think it's really goofy whenever there's something that portrays a triumph of the human spirit in World War One. You know, any right. small anecdote, any
it's,
film.
It's why we don't set movies in World War One directly film, once World War II started.
Any film like Paths of Glory that goes, and at the end of World War One, people really learn to treat other people as human beings. And then it's kind of like that.
For several years.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like that joke on the internet when Germany finally finished paying off their World War One debts. And there is that image of... it said it was like a board meeting of the German government and they go, all right. And in finances, we finally paid off our World War One debts. What's next on the agenda? And then somebody opens a book and goes, oh.
Yeah, but that's the thing that's great is the movie's more aware than that. It doesn't end with the uplifting moment. It ends with the Kirk Douglas and that's how the machine works. And we're just going to keep doing it.
Right.
That humanity did not win here today. That in fact, there was another world war. And people didn't immediately leave here and start thinking of the German people as more than something to be masturbated over in a saloon. I don't actually think that was a huge problem of World War One that we were masturbating over the Germans, but in this specific scene, perhaps it was. Or maybe that's how the war was won. What do I know? We have a website, doublefeatureshow.com. The email address is doublefeatureshow@icloud.com. And Liam Duffy, Greg Winter, Seth Hanasek, and Matthew Berry were kind enough to help back our show as executive producers during our Kickstarter. And that's why you can hear us talk about masturbation for an entire year at good old Double Feature.
Yeah. Next week, we've got two films specifically about masturbation. We've got Tokyo Drifter and The Departed.
I don't remember. Well, whatever. That's fine.
Which is actually kind of interesting to me that we're covering The Departed because we talked a little bit early on before we finished the year about using Scorsese as our other New York.
Oh, yeah. So we did.
Although The Departed...
He snuck his way on anyways.
The Departed is Boston, but we might still get a little bit of that conversation in there. But yeah, I guess, you know, watch more fucking film.
Bye.